This year, I am focused on saving and investing, but I still want to do things like travel. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering 10 times points on your spending, which means you could end up with a free flight or maybe a better hotel room.
So what could future you do with smarter financial decisions? Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
If you've ever been in the market for a new home, you know home shopping can be a lot. There's so much you don't know and so much you need to know. What are the neighborhoods like? What are the schools like? Who is the agent who knows the listing or neighborhood best? And why can't all this information just be in one place?
Well, now it is on Homes.com. They've got everything you need to know about the listing itself, but even better. They've got comprehensive neighborhood guides and detailed reports about local schools. And their agent directory helps you see the agent's current listings and sales history. Homes.com collaboration tools make it easier than ever to share all this information with your family. It's a whole cul-de-sac of home shopping information all at your fingertips. Homes.com. We've done your homework. Hello and welcome to Happier, a podcast about how to be happier. This week is a milestone episode for us. It is our very first Happier Podcast Book Club episode, and we are so excited. I'm Gretchen Rubin, a writer who studies happiness, good habits, and human nature. I'm in New York City, and with me is my sister and fellow book lover, Elizabeth Kraft.
That's me, Elizabeth Kraft, a TV writer and producer living in Los Angeles. And Gretchen, I cannot believe that this is the first time I've been in a book club.
How is that possible?
I don't know. If you'd asked me, I would have said, oh, I've been in a million book clubs. But then I thought about it and I thought, oh my gosh, I have never been in a book club.
I mean, you're in a Mahjong club and you're not in a book club.
I mean, that is... I know.
Yes. So now you are, though. We've tackled
now
it.
Now I am.
Now you are.
Yes, thank goodness.
But before we talk about our big book of the episode, which we're so excited to launch into, I do want to talk about my own book and say thank you to everyone for all the interest and enthusiasm in Outer Order, Inner Calm. It's so exciting. It's so fun for me. I so appreciate the response that I've gotten from everyone. So thank you so much. I'm on the road still for my Outer Order Inner Calm book tour, and we are going to do Happier Podcast live events. You can get all the information at GretchenRubin.com/events. Coming up, we're going to talk a lot more about the live events and what to expect and where we're going and all that. But in the meantime, you can mark your calendar and get the basics by going to GretchenRubin.com/events.
I cannot wait, Gretch.
And now it's time for the book club. So this choice, Elizabeth, was so easy for us. When we were like, we're going to do a Happier Podcast book club, we knew that we wanted to do this book. And everyone has been loving this book. It has been a huge bestseller. It's just making a huge splash because it's such a terrific book.
The author is Danny Shapiro. Danny Shapiro is the best-selling author of 4 memoirs, all of which I've read,
Me
and
too.
5 novels. Her most recent book hit the shelves a couple of months ago, and it's a big bestseller and getting tremendous buzz. It is her 5th memoir, Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love.
Yes, and here's the official description. What makes us who we are? In the spring of 2016, through a genealogy website to which she had whimsically submitted her DNA for analysis, Danny Shapiro received the stunning news that her father was not her biological father. She woke up one morning and her entire history, the life she had lived, crumbled beneath her. Inheritance is a book about secrets, secrets within families, kept out of shame or self-protectiveness, secrets we keep from one another in the name of love. It is the story of a woman's urgent quest to unlock the story of her own identity, a story that has been scrupulously hidden from her for more than 50 years. Years she had spent writing brilliantly and compulsively on themes of identity and family history. And inspired by this project, we should say, Dani recently launched an absolutely riveting podcast called Family Secrets.
Yes, I love her new podcast.
So, Dani, welcome. It's so great to have you here in the studio with me.
It's fantastic to be with you.
Yay.
This is so exciting. And Dani, before we launch into inheritance, I have mentioned this before on the podcast, but I have to tell everyone again, you were my first writing teacher at Columbia. It was just so seminal for me. I remember the very first writing exercise you had us do. And I don't know if you still use this.
What was it, Liz?
But you said, this is their wedding photo. And then you said, okay, now write something. And I started writing and I'm like, oh my God, like this is good for me. Like I just felt very natural. And that was sort of like the first moment when I was a writer. So thank you.
That's amazing. That's amazing to hear. I love that. And did I actually give you a photo or was it the idea that it was your parents' wedding photo?
No, there was no actual photo. You just said, yeah, maybe it was, this is my parents' wedding photo. Maybe that was it.
How interesting. And
oh my gosh, now.
Complicated in retrospect.
In retrospect, oh my gosh, there's a whole level to that.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, wow. That is crazy. Wow. Wow. And it's a special treat for me to have you here with us, live and in person in New York City. Now we're going to go in to ask all the questions, and I'm going to tell our listeners, spoilers will abound. We are going to be talking about everything from the beginning to the end, but it really doesn't make a difference in how much you love the book. I think even if you haven't read it, you can still enjoy this conversation. If you're inspired by this conversation to go read it, you will still enjoy it. It's that kind of book. You don't give it away.
I've been on book tour for the last 6 weeks and I've been telling audiences exactly that because I know people who know the whole story intimately and then they read the book and they write to me the next day and they say, I knew what happened and I was up till 2 o'clock in the morning to find out what happened.
It is that kind of book. Yeah. But so to give everyone a flavor of the book, especially people who haven't yet had a chance to read it, would you please read like one of your favorite passages from the book?
Of course. It had been 11, maybe 12 hours since Michael sat next to me in my office, a sequence of numbers unlocking the combination to a me I hadn't known. In those hours, I had felt sorrow, despair, alienation, numbness, shock, confusion, mostly confusion, and also something else. I was on the hunt. A fact-finding mission had taken me over, keeping the deeper reservoir of feelings at bay. Your father is still your father. It was a loving thing to say, meant to console, but I didn't know what it could possibly mean that my father was still my father. I was at the beginning of a journey, one that I would walk alone, step by treacherous step. It felt like a truism, a cliche, a salve. I loved my father with all my heart and had devoted much of my life to him. But in purely clinical terms, he wasn't my father. There was someone out there, some anonymous man, possibly alive, probably dead, maybe a sperm donor who had once been a medical student at the University of Pennsylvania, who was technically, biologically, my father. A point of fact.
Wow, that gives me chills.
That gives me, I mean, chills. Yes. Oh, my God.
Wow.
Dani, you have always written so much about your parents. Do you think ultimately this is why? Do you think it led you to this?
Yeah, in a way I do. There's kind of two ways of thinking about it. And one is that it was sort of this divinely ordained thing that I was this writer and then had this story that I uncovered and was in a position to tell it, was in a position to write about it. What feels more resonant to me is that what made me a writer, that I was digging and digging, that each of my novels, I've written 5 novels, they all center around family secrets.
Uh-huh.
Every single one of them. It was my theme, the corrosive power of family secrets. And then my memoirs. I mean, when I started writing memoir, I was like, why?
Yeah.
Why all these memoirs? I mean, one, okay.
Yeah.
But then I became this serial memoirist.
I read them all. They're all great. Yeah. Yes, but why the
digging,
desire?
Digging. I mean, like the image that I've had over the last few years, it's of this vast field with lots of little places where mounds of dirt were dug up. Like, okay, I'm digging here now. Now I'm digging here, but I didn't know what I was digging for.
Ah.
And do you think the second you found out this secret, you knew you'd end up writing about it? Or was that just not even on your mind because you were so blown away?
I mean, I think in the moment, I was blown away and shocked and sort of destabilized. But, You know, I think writers have this in common. There was also part of me that floated up to some corner mm-hmm. in the ceiling and was already observing and already trying to understand, because writing is the way that I try to understand things. It's how I know what I feel is by writing. And so pretty quickly I was taking notes, but not in a clinical way, more like I was just trying to capture everything about the raw experience as I was experiencing it.
Well, here's a question from a listener that is kind of touches on that. Diana asks, I've read all your memoirs and love them. The memoir is my favorite genre, but I notice when I talk about memoirs in my book clubs or with friends that a subset of people get very judgmental of the author. Although, of course, it takes tremendous courage and insight to be honest about one's flaws. How do you handle judgments as an artist and a human?
That is a great question. So, first of all, I think people somehow think that the bar is lower when it comes to memoir. Mm. And I actually think the bar is higher when it comes to memoir. Mm. Because the writer is combating a kind of skepticism or bias or sense in some critics and some readers that because it happened, the writer's then judged. I mean, certainly criticism does that all the time, like judges the life and not the writing, when in fact, the way that I think of it for myself is I'm telling a story and I'm telling it in the best possible way I can, and I'm shaping the chaos of life into, hopefully, literature. And that is different from taking imagination and making literature out of it. I've done both, but it's by no means easier to write memoir. And I just actually think, well, this is a story that I've told, and it happens to be carved out of the facts of my life.
Do you find that people just come up to you and feel they can comment on your personal life?
Most often they tell me that they feel that they know me. And which I take as a compliment. I mean, that means that they felt a sense of intimacy with my work. Sometimes what they'll do is they'll start telling me their deepest, darkest secrets.
Yes.
Which it took me a long time to figure out why people were doing that. And I realized that it was because they're trying to say, you know, now I want you to know me. I feel like I know you.
Yeah. It's interesting. Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote of her books, I told the truth, but not the whole truth.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't all belong. It doesn't all go in. Yes. Or I think it was Annie Dillard who once said something like, you don't get credit for living.
Right. It's got to do something. Now, here's an interesting question that I have to say I'd wondered myself. Carol asks, why was the dress on the book cover? I kept thinking there would be some mention of a special dress, but then there wasn't.
So that dress was actually my dress. It's a great story. When my last book, Hourglass, had just come out, I was on book tour, and this fabric artist named Diana Waymar came up to me and she said, do you have an article of clothing that I could make something out of? And I immediately thought about that little dress because I was already in the throes of my discovery that eventually became Inheritance. I was thinking a lot about myself as a little girl and everything that I didn't know. And that was a dress that I wore as a flower girl at a cousin's wedding. And it wasn't like in mothballs or anything. It was like lying in my basement in a pile of stuff. And I wish, Gretchen, if it were you, it probably would be very well preserved and taken.
Right, would have been gone.
Yeah, so or gone. You're lucky. Exactly. Yeah. But mine was like, it was like sitting like next to the sort of defunct wine cellar. So I remembered the dress and I sent it to her. And as she started working on it to make her art out of it, she started sending me pictures of the dress on her light box. And when it came time to design a cover, and there were some ideas for covers that weren't really working, and I remembered the little dress, and I had all of these images. It was a pure accident. And then the art director at my publisher, who's brilliant, because the dress was actually ice blue.
Oh.
She took the dress and made it into that sort of like flesh tone pinky color. Because if you think of if you think of it as ice blue, it would look like a disturbing story or a ghost story. And instead, just this kind of
childhood.
Childhood, exactly.
Oh, that's beautiful.
That is a great story. Danny, Stephanie has an interesting question. She says, does Danny think that one of the reasons her bio family was so welcoming is because she is very accomplished? Did she ever get the impression that if she were a factory worker or a sales clerk, they may not have been so open to meeting? I asked because there is a lot of emphasis in the book on writing emails in a way that is non-offensive, direct, but polite. And had she written him with emojis and bad spelling and not as compelling a background, if they would have dismissed her outright?
It's a great question, and it's a tough question. I mean, I actually think that my being accomplished as a writer was initially detrimental to...
Ooh, because they must have known right away this could be a book.
Well, in my initial note to my biological father, it was a pretty brief note, but I wrote, I included my website. And I included my website, honestly, so that he would see that I was relatively successful and that I had a family of my own and that I probably didn't want anything from him. But at the same time, what I didn't really consider is that if you looked at my website on the homepage, and I thought, oh, he'll see a picture of me, he'll see how much like him I look.
Yeah.
But there was also a picture of me with Oprah with her arm around me. And that's not a plus in that situation. I mean, I really think he thought, this woman is going to like knock on my door and I'm going to open it and there's going to be Oprah and a camera crew.
I never even thought of that, of course.
And he's a very private person. Yeah. And also, I think he dug a little bit into what I have written about over time, and I've written a lot about family and identity. And so, yeah, absolutely, I think he was quaking in his boots at the idea that I would somehow expose him or invade his family's privacy. Now, that's not totally answering the question, though. I do think it's complicated when there is a real cultural divide or what seems like a divide. And I think certainly there are lots of situations in which that happens. I think one of the biggest fears, and I'm hearing this a lot as I'm on the road, one of the biggest fears of sperm donors when they get contacted, as they are right and left these days, is a kind of what do you want from me?
Yes.
I don't think emojis or bad spelling are the issue. I think when there's a sense of a threat or a demand, that's more of an issue. And then sometimes there are just these men who are so terrified that they're going to feel anything as a threat or a demand. So, you know, there are really happy stories and then there are really hard stories out there.
Right. Well, I want to skip ahead because these were great questions, but these are three related questions that tie into what the point you were just making about your biological father. Chris asks, how did the, quote, Waldens feel about your book? Was it hard for them? How did they come to the point of being okay with it, if they were? Mary said, I would love to know how Danny's biological family reacted to inheritance and if she has continued to develop a relationship with them. And then Maggie says, she mentions getting to know her half-sister, but did her half-brothers want to contact? If so, how did it go? So this is all related to how did they come to grips with the idea of you as a writer, and then how did it unfold?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about our relationship, I think, is from the beginning, everybody really tried to do the right thing.
Oh, which is so rare, and it takes you so far.
It really does.
And just use polite manners.
Really.
Can hurt to just be
there was
like,
thoughtfulness,
calm.
There was kindness, there was care from the beginning. And so one of the things, not from the very start, but from the time that we started getting to know each other, is that I was transparent about the fact that I was writing a book.
So you didn't sandbag him?
Not at all, no. I think I wrote to him pretty early on something to the effect of course I will be writing about this, but I will protect your identity. And that was something that was very important to me, to be honest about it, but also to protect his identity. I went to great lengths to protect his identity, even tiny little details in the book. Like, for example, there's a moment in the book where I reference that we are exchanging emails about like sharing poems with each other. And there's a particular poet whose work I send him, and he writes back to me and thanks me for the poem and that he was going to put it up on his blog. And all of a sudden, as I was writing the book, I thought, oh, I'm going to change the name of that poet. Because if you typed in the poet and retired physician and blog, maybe you could get to it. I mean, things that were at that level.
Yeah. Yes.
But as then, I might have done, as, you know, I could see people doing that.
100%.
Yeah. And so then in that vein, when I finished the manuscript, I sent it to him.
You did.
I did. And I've never in my life done that for any family member. You know, it's like a memoir 101 no-no to send a manuscript, which is like wet clay. It's like sending somebody a mound of wet clay and saying, like, just don't touch the wet clay, but is the wet clay okay with you?
Right.
I mean, the inclination is to want to start changing things when you receive a manuscript, any manuscript. But I did, and it was a risk, but it was one that I felt very strongly that I wanted to take because— First of all, I wanted to make sure that he felt his identity was protected. Maybe he would have seen something that I hadn't seen.
Yeah.
And I suppose I also wanted his blessing. I wanted him to like the book.
So what did he say?
He loved the book. He wrote me a long response to it that was very caring and incisive and, you know, bullet points.
Really? And,
yeah. He's a very organized person, sort of like me.
One of my favorite moments was when your husband says, he even runs a Q&A the way you do. I was like, oh my gosh, that is You know, I mean, just when he, your husband was helping you with the research and seeing that, well, yeah, and you're looking at the video for the first time.
That we laid eyes on
him. Yeah, so because I think you're you would send an email with bullet points too.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And then in terms of, he has three children, a daughter is the oldest, and then two sons. The sons have not been all that interested in me, I think just because they're just not. Uh-huh. And I therefore have not been that interested in them. Also, I didn't grow up with a brother. It's like, what's a brother? I don't know how to have a brother. But I mean, if they had been interested or if they were to be interested, I would be interested too. Again, this really just had to do with respecting each other's boundaries and privacy and sense of self. And his daughter, who's only 6 years younger than I am, grew up with two brothers and always kind of wanted to have a sister. And now, you know, now she has one. And so, yes, we are in touch. But I will say this, one thing that I came to after I finished the book and knowing I was going out on book tour is that I decided that moving forward in my life with the Waldens, I am not going to keep talking about our life moving forward. I'll talk about everything as it relates to the book and the experience of the book. And the feeling really is, let's have a private life with each other.
Right. That now the book has been sort of put to bed. That's one experience. And now you're going to go ahead and...
Yeah. And I'll talk till Kingdom Come about the experiences in the book and everything that connects to what it's like to find a biological father and about identity and, you know, fatherhood and, you know, this whole experience that we're all in, really, of these secrets tumbling out of the closet, you know, in this moment that we're in. I think I almost feel like I was put here to have this conversation.
Right.
But also not the unfolding over the course of a lifetime of these new relationships and this modern family that, you know, we're all trying to figure out.
So Deirdre asked a question, but she says it's perhaps flippant, but it's interesting. How do you regret the tattoo? You get a tattoo. How do you feel about the tattoo?
I love my tattoo.
She loves her tattoo. Can I take a picture of the tattoo to post on the website?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, good.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So
we should have Danny say what it is so everyone can picture it.
Though. Yeah.
So one of the things really early on in my discovery, like within days, was I had the thought that had never crossed my mind before of wanting to get a tattoo. And some people have wondered whether it was because I discovered that, in fact, I'm not entirely Jewish and that biologically I'm half Jewish because there's the prohibition in Judaism for getting a tattoo. Not at all. I don't think it had anything to do with that. It was a feeling of, I have discovered that my body is actually not the body that I thought it was. And I want to mark that occasion.
Kind of the transition.
The before and after and the transition.
Fascinating.
And I thought long and hard. I think the reason I don't regret it is because I didn't like wander into a tattoo too hard that day.
Yeah,
and
go, kids,
like,
think it over.
Yeah. You know, had like a couple of beers. No, I didn't do that. Yeah. I thought about it for like a year and a half. And I thought about exactly the tattoo artist I wanted to go to. This man named Dr. Wu in Los Angeles, who it turns out is very, very, very hard to get in to see. He has millions of Instagram followers. So I had to like really, really chase him down. And I wanted him as he makes these very beautiful birds that also have compasses incorporated into their design. And I thought a lot about compasses and the sense of sort of direction and grounding and like knowing who I am and where I come from.
Coming up, we'll hear a reader's favorite passage of Inheritance, but first this break.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and free. And, you know, Elizabeth, I now work with a team, and hiring the right people is so important. It's maybe the most important thing. And LinkedIn makes the process of identifying and hiring people easy and intuitive. I know that when I've been hiring for my team, it's hard to find quality candidates to interview. And LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn.
Post your job for free at linkedin.com/Gretchen. That's linkedin.com/Gretchen to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
The weather's getting warmer, so it's time to say goodbye to jackets and sweaters and hello to shorts and tees. I wanted to update my wardrobe without spending a fortune, and luckily I found Quince. Elizabeth, I got the Flowknit wide leg pant. It's very light. It's perfect for the summer. It packs very easily. I recently went on a trip with my family, and I took it with me, and they were just the thing to wear on a really hot day where I wanted to be covered up, but I wanted something that looked great and also was very comfortable.
And the best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/Gretchen for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/Gretchen to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/Gretchen.
So, Danny, this comes from Julie. I loved reading her comment. Julie writes, I really enjoyed listening to Inheritance. I was walking the dogs at the moment when Danny's aunt said she wouldn't let her go, and I began crying. I can even feel the tears coming now as I write this. This was such a lovely, true, special, important, vital thing, and everything about it is what I want the world to be like. So would you read the passage that I knew? The minute she mentioned it, I knew exactly the part that she was talking about. This is when you go to visit your aunt, your brother's sister.
That's so beautiful, by the way. Thank you for that. I feel like the chance to expose the world in any way to my Aunt Shirley makes me very happy. Everyone.
Well, yeah, she must have loved the book. It's like she's a great character in it.
She actually, she called me. I sent her one of the very first copies that I received from my publisher, and she called me as she was reading it, and she said, actually, I got it, and I was leafing through it, and I opened up to the page of the scene between you and me.
Oh, okay, so it's this very moment. So, yes. Oh, that's so beautiful.
Chills again.
Yeah. This is on page 136, by the way, if you want to go back and read it yourself.
So just to set the scene, I had flown to Chicago to see my father's younger sister. She was 93 and a half years old at the time. She's now 95 and a half. Half years make a big difference when you're in your 90s, when you're a toddler and when you're in your 90s. And I had just broken the news to her that my father had not been my biological father. I had wondered if she had known. It became very clear to me that she had not known. And this is what she said. So you're saying, Dad is not my biological father, I said. Five words and a lifetime. Her eyes were locked onto mine. I was afraid she was going to stop breathing. Not a blink, not a sound. I feared it was as if I had said to her, you're not mine, I'm not yours, we don't belong to each other. It felt violent. The world around us fell away. She leaned slightly forward, reached out, and grabbed my hand. I'm not giving you up, she said. The thin shell holding me together cracked, and suddenly I was weeping with my whole body. And you'd better not be giving me up, she said. Every syllable, deliberate. I'm not giving you up, Cheryl, I sobbed. I was so afraid that I have fewer years ahead of me than behind me, she said. And you are my brother's daughter.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's just so powerful.
She spent that whole afternoon trying to like stitch me back together again. It was...
She was just grappling with it for herself.
She was just grappling with it. She had had no idea. And I write in the book, it was the purest manifestation of love I have ever felt. She just went into this mode, somehow intuitively understanding what it would feel like to discover that. And at one point she said to me, you are not an accident of history. And it became something over the course of the entire journey that I was on as I was writing the book. And I'm still on the journey. It became a kind of refrain as I would think about it, like, at one point later on, I thought, either we're all accidents of history or none of us are accidents of history. But to make that discovery in midlife is to feel like an accident of history, at least initially. It is to feel sort of alien and other. And she somehow intuited that.
Yes. That in that she could instantly go to the core of it and understand.
Yeah, she drilled right down all the way to the core of it and then did everything she possibly could to try to heal me.
Ugh. And Danny, do you think that this whole journey ultimately made you closer to the family you were raised with? Your family?
I think it made me closer. I mean, I was already so close to my Aunt Shirley. I don't know that we could have gotten closer, but in a way, I do think we got closer because I think I had a habit of underestimating somehow what she would be able to tolerate or how she would be able to, you know, handle something like that. She just surprised me right and left with her capacity to sort of step up and move beyond, you know, in making any difference whether we were related biologically or not. Her larger family, I actually really haven't spoken with about this, so I don't know. And that's really all the family. Well, there is also my father's younger brother's, well, this gets complicated, but my father's younger brother's ex-wife.
Modern family.
They divorced when I was 13, but she is still my aunt. And she has written me the most extraordinary notes. And at one point she wrote to me right when the book came out and said, I believe your parents would be proud of you. I don't know about that, but the fact that she believed that meant a lot to me.
Well, one thing that comes up in the book is how often throughout your life, I mean, clearly something that came up over and over was people questioning your identity kind of to your face. They would say, are you Jewish? You say you're Jewish. Are you really Jewish? And apart from it being so completely inappropriate for people to sort of, you know, question someone else's identity like that, in retrospect, how do you think about that? Because it clearly was a theme in the book that it was part of like the tiles falling into place or the feeling that there had been a secret or there had been something that you hadn't known or that was hidden from you in a way that was made you uneasy.
Yeah, I think I fought it for so much of my life whenever anybody would say that to me. You don't look Jewish. You can't possibly.
I mean, because you are who you are.
Right.
You are who you are.
Right. And they said it to me every day of my life. And inwardly, my feeling would be, you know, well, this is what Jewish looks like, and what's your problem?
Yeah. You
know? And so I didn't really think it affected me. I didn't connect it to my feeling of otherness or not belonging. And now it's so clear that it had to be connected. When you're told that you pretty much aren't who you believe you are, you know, every day, that is going to contribute to that sense of I don't belong or I'm different or why am I different or why don't I feel like I belong? And so when I made this discovery, I mean, very quickly, it felt like, first of all, oh, that's why people were saying that. They were actually seeing something that I couldn't see. Looking into the mirror, my own face reflected back at me, didn't actually make sense. And, you know, it's a charged thing to say, you know, doesn't look this way or doesn't look that way. But what I've come to actually is that when people were saying that, what they were recognizing is that I did look like I came from a different part of the world. I do look like I'm from Western Europe. I look like my biological father and his family. And so there was this way in which I think that was constantly being commented on in some way in front of my parents, which must have made them supremely uncomfortable, unconsciously perhaps. But yet in our family, it was just something that was made light of. And it was always this joke, you know, when I was 3 years old and I was the Kodak Christmas poster child wishing the entire world a Merry Christmas.
By the way, I looked for that online. I was trying, I'm like, I really want to see that picture.
I have it on my phone. I can show it to you.
Okay, well, can I post it on, can I post it?
I'll give it
to
you.
Okay, everyone, if you were wondering what that looked like, and if you even Googled it like I did, we're getting the inside scoop and getting the actual Kodak photo.
Absolutely.
Because that's a crazy story too.
It was a crazy story, but in my family, in my Orthodox Jewish family, that Christmas poster where this Orthodox Jewish girl is wishing the entire world a Merry Christmas was like, oh, isn't that hilarious?
Yeah.
You know, we're just fooling everybody. Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
You know, meanwhile, when you know the truth of my conception and of my identity, it's not fun at all. So that was always enormously, I mean, that has become very, that's one of the mysteries for me. I'm still confused by it. Why did my father agree to allow this, you know, this image of his in fact, non-biological daughter, paternity unknown, to be wishing the whole world a Merry Christmas.
But that just, he just feels so connected to you. It's like maybe it just
that it just didn't matter.
Yeah. And I think it's worth noting that you were growing up in a very, very Orthodox, you know, this wasn't just some incidental aspect of your life. This was like a major aspect of your daily life and your daily existence was Judaism.
And it was my father's, it was like sort of core to his identity.
Well, and your whole family was sort of eminent in that community. And it was, you know, it wasn't just.
No, I was fluent in Hebrew. I went to a Jewish day school.
So, Danny, before I get to my next question, I know everyone's telling you their stories of sperm donors and finding out these identities, but I have to tell you the story of my writing partner, Sarah, who had her child with a sperm donor. To make a long story short, she was in a music class with her daughter, and she had gone on to the donor sibling registry and done a little bit of research, but decided, I don't even want to go there. But her daughter started playing with twin boys who were in the class with two moms. And they were just very much drawn together. And it was very remarkable. And everyone was talking about it. And sort of a cold chill went down Sarah's body. And she thought, oh, my God, I think those may be Violet's donor siblings. Mm-hmm. And she went home and she looked at the registry. And in fact, they were her donor siblings. Mm-hmm. And they are. And it has led to this incredible journey of Sarah becoming close with those boys and their moms, as well as getting to know like 15 other donor siblings. So it's been a whole thing. So that really resonated with me in what I kind of felt was the most electric moment for me of the book, when your donor father's wife said, you won't tell anyone else about this, right? As if there are other people out there, you won't tell them who he is. And it made me wonder if you are interested in donor siblings, if that would be a journey that you'd continue on.
Yeah, it's I knew where you were going with that story once you got to it's really
the word donor sibling.
It's personally, of course I would be interested if half siblings appear, you know, on ancestry.com or any of the places where I have spread my DNA around. It's interesting that they haven't. And I would not be surprised if they don't. I would not be surprised if I'm sort of a rare sort of like unicorn of like, I'm the only one. Because many of the people who discover that they were donor conceived, especially, especially my age, but that's not true. I mean, just all the way through, whose identity was hidden from them and then discover that they're donor conceived, then discover scores of half-siblings, like almost immediately. It's like there's this 1-2 punch of like, you're donor conceived and guess what? You have, you know, 37 half-siblings or 45 half-siblings or 18 half-siblings. And that's, I think, a very complicated thing as an adult to discover, as opposed to this generation of kids who are growing up who are growing up in communities where being donor conceived is out in the open, where parents have disclosed to them, where there is a sense of being around, you know, lots of other kids, both related to them and not related to them, who are conceived in the same way. And so it eradicates any feeling of otherness or shame or confusion or alienation that goes along with the hiddenness. You know, and there's still hiddenness. I mean, in same-sex couples, there isn't that hiddenness, but still with heterosexual couples who have used donor eggs or donor sperm, there's still a fair number of people who do not disclose. And so there continues to be these secrets of identity that are pouring out over every generation right now.
Well, and now you have your podcast, your wonderful podcast that Liz and I have both listened to, Family Secrets. And you are able to start exploring more and more of these kinds of secrets, all different kinds of family secrets.
All different kinds of family secrets. Yes. I mean, some of them are DNA related. Yeah. Some of them are not, or their ethnicity. Or, I mean, the way that I've been thinking of it, and this is being borne out as I'm traveling, is that it feels to me that we are in an era that is the era of the end of the secret. I mean, the combination of these easy, accessible DNA testing that so many people are doing, it's the most popular holiday gift now every Christmas. Families are getting it for each other. 12 million people.
My mother-in-law gave it to me like a couple years ago, just like as a lark, kind of the way you did it.
Recreationally.
Oh, this is fun.
Right. So last year, 12 million people bought these kits.
Wow.
And out of those 12 million people, 2%, so that's 240,000, are discovering what's known as an NPE in that world, which means not parent expected.
Wow.
So that's 240,000 people a year.
Whoa.
Just the people who are doing these tests. And there are all these people who are walking around like I was, who had no idea. But so many other kinds of secrets. But the one thing that seems true beneath all of that secret keeping is like, why do we keep a secret?
Uh-huh.
We keep a secret because underneath that there is shame. And if we shine a light on it, the shame goes away. Because all we really do is, you know, we're essentially saying, oh, me too.
Right.
Some version of me too.
Yeah.
Coming up, we will continue our conversation with my former writing teacher, Danny Shapiro. But first, this break.
We're so excited to introduce you to Great Jones. Great Jones makes high-quality, thoughtfully designed cookware that's so stunning you won't want to put it away. They have everything from Dutch ovens to ceramic dishes to non-stick sheet pans. They've got everything you want. I have the Saucy, which is a terrific saucepan. It has curved sides. It has a pouring spout. It has a lid. And it looks so elegant. It's really a pleasure just to look at it on the counter, even before we're using it.
Yes, I love all the colors.
Yeah.
They make stunning gifts that are actually useful. Weddings, housewarming parties, birthdays. It's the perfect gift for the foodie in your life. So upgrade your kitchen and replace those old rusted hand-me-downs with bold, beautiful, long-lasting pieces from Great Jones. Get started today at greatjones.com and get an extra 15% off your first order with promo code HAPPIER. That's greatjones.com, promo code HAPPIER. Gretch, I love eating sandwiches, like a grilled cheese or a peanut butter sandwich is my ideal lunch, but I'm very aware of my carb intake, so oftentimes I avoid sandwiches. Luckily, Hero Bread has remade carby, empty-calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious versions that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Plus, it has protein and fiber. I have been using it to make grilled cheeses, and I use their tortillas to make a cheese quesadilla, and I am in heaven.
Hero Bread tastes great, has a terrific texture, and helps you meet your nutrition goals. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use Happier at checkout. That's Happier at hero.co. Well, Danny, we need to let you go because you are in the middle of like a whirlwind crazy book tour. We love the book so much, but we have to ask you before we let you go, do you have a try this at home tip? We ask every guest if you have a concrete, manageable resolution that you would suggest to listeners as something they can do to make themselves happier.
Well, I meditate every morning.
Mm.
And I have for a few years now. There is an app that helped me enormously called Insight Timer.
Mm.
And the reason why Insight Timer helped me is because they actually hold you accountable.
Mm.
The app will tell you how many days in a row you've meditated.
Ah.
And at first I didn't like that because I thought, I don't want to be competitive about this. Yeah. I'm competitive about so many things. But it actually held me accountable so that I wouldn't break my streak.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you have hundreds of days in a row, I mean, even if it's 5 o'clock in the morning, I got to get up a half an hour earlier like I did this morning. Or, you know, that... For me, it's 20 minutes.
That's a lot.
It's a lot, but it doesn't have to
be. That's a lot.
It could be 5 minutes.
I did 5. I had to quit. Yeah. But no, it didn't do anything for me, but that's impressive. So you have a serious streak of 20-minute meditation.
Well, to be honest, while I was on my book tour, it got broken. So I'm back to, day two. But that was after, I think, 450 straight days.
Wow.
But the thing that it does is I think of my mind as such a busy mind, right? Mm-hmm. And we all have such noisy lives. And it's like my mind is like a snow globe that's all shaken up. And if I sit there for a while and I just watch my thoughts, I watch them come, I watch them go, and I catch myself planning, listing, thinking, noting, perseverating, whatever it is, I notice it. And if I notice it, then I can stop it. So I think it's that practice. It's just noticing the fluctuations of the mind. I think people think about meditation that it's something that you can excel at or be good at, or you're a bad meditator if you can't stop thinking. It's just noticing that you're thinking
uh-huh.
and returning to the breath.
Well, Dani, thank you so much. Our listeners just loved this book. There's been just tremendous enthusiasm and excitement about your book, your podcast. I will put links to everything in the show notes. The picture of you as the Kodak Christmas person, the links to the book.
Her tattoo.
Yeah, the tattoo. Many people mentioned how much they love the audiobook and you listening. You have a beautiful speaking voice. You enunciate so beautifully. All these links will be there. If you haven't read the book yet, you will still love it. So thank you for being our inaugural book club author.
I am honored. Thank you both for having me.
Thank you, Dani.
So again, we'd still love to hear your thoughts on this terrific memoir. Let us know on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Drop us an email at podcast@gretchenrubin.com. As always, you can go to happiercast.com/212 for everything that we talked about related to this episode. Remember, whenever it is and wherever you are, there's always a book waiting for you. And that's it for this episode of Happier. We hope you love the book Inheritance and being part of the book club discussion. Soon we'll announce our next choice.
Thank you to the brilliant Dani Shapiro. We so appreciate her joining us in the studio and answering questions from our listeners. Again, her memoir is Inheritance. Thank you to our executive producer, Chuck Reed, our engineer, Bob Tabador, and everyone at Cadence 13. Get in touch. Gretchen's on Instagram at Gretchen Rubin, and I'm at Liz Craft. Our email address is podcast@gretchenrubin.com.
If you like the show, please be sure to tell a friend and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. The resources for this week. If you would like the free manifesto for Outer Order, it's actually not in the book. You can get it at gretchenrubin.com/resources. And if you would like to get an email every time there's a new podcast episode, you can sign up at gretchenrubin.com/newsletter to get an email with the show notes for every episode.
Until next week, I'm Elizabeth Kraft.
And I'm Gretchen Rubin. Thanks for joining us. Onward and upward.
All right, so Gretch, in the crazy small world vein, so, you know, Dani has a writer's retreat in Italy every year.
Yeah.
And one of the people she co-founded it with is Jim Shepherd, and he was Sarah's writing teacher at Williams.
Wait, so your writing teacher and Sarah's writing teacher have a writing conference together?
Yes, in Italy every year.
That is crazy.
Yes.
That
and it's our dream in life to go.
You gotta go. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Someday.
From the Onward Project.